Accession number 15736, Ernie Tompkins, reel 7.
Tompkins, reel 7. We're talking about how on the 6th of March 1919 you force landed a DH-4, having taken it across the channel. Do you want to carry on? You were talking about what happened after the landing.
So I said to him, I said, well, you caught that luck? I said, the first time I've landed an airplane like that. And I said, where's the nearest phone? He told me, and I said, I've got no coppers for the phone, so he lent me some coppers, see. And I rang up the aerodrome, and I asked them, send a party out, of course, and take me down to the Burlington Hotel. And there was a reason for that, which I'll tell you in a minute. So they sent the party out, and Judy took me down to the Burlington Hotel. Now then, the next day, they gave me a day off. So I went over to Hastings. I knew some friends there. And the following day, I boarded the destroyer to take me to the Mole. That is the duty destroyer, the naval duty destroyer, see.
Back to Dunkirk?
That's back to the Mole. No, back to the Mole at Zeebrugge. Because this is after the war, see? We'd taken over Zeebrugge then, look, see? We were at Varson Air, look. So it took me, and the major met me with two flight captains. I thought it was strange. And we sat in the car. Oh, coming back to I said about the golf course.
That's what you'd landed on?
Yes, I should have mentioned that I ran into this bunker. It was on the golf course. So the major, we sat down and the major said, good show, Tom. And I couldn't figure out why it was a good show. So I said, by the by, I said, weren't the other two supposed to be coming back with me? He said, they won't ever be coming back, Tom. Well, I realized that I had to make a report out on the circumstances concerning the crash. I thought it was strange because my airplane wasn't crashed by any means. So I made out this report. And of course, I left the squadron the next day, I think it was. Now, I wondered why I had to. He said they won't ever be coming back. Now, I didn't hear anything about this until this Peter Pavey, the Heritage, Rolls-Royce Heritage Trust man, came. And he was very surprised. I met him down there, and he saw my name in the old flight and aeroplane when I was gazetted and that thing. So he came, and he brought me a book, £16 book. All the aeroplanes that was used by 202 Squadron was in that book, from 1911 to 1919, including my own. And he had it marked off. That's what I was going to look for, the sheet I got. And it said there, to Dover. This is 5988, the number of the machine. I think you'll find that's right.
6988, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
5988.
6988. Well, according to your logbook, it's 6988.
Oh, 6988. Oh, yes, that's right. It could be 6988. So, in this logbook, it said that from Dover, to Dover, arrived in the dark. Force landed at the golf links, St. Margaret's Bay, Westcliff Park, St. Margaret's Bay, second left on Tompkins, unhurt. Now, also in that book, I only heard that one chap was crashed and the other chap went down in the sea. I don't know about that one. In that book, it said, same as mine, but it did say from Barcenair, which it didn't say mine, to Dover. Crashed at such and such an address they gave me. Crashed. And that's all. They never said anything about the pilot. Crashed. Well, I heard he was killed, see. Well, then the other chap I heard came down in the harbour. It was very unfortunate how it all came about. Because had they known the weather was going to be turning, you can't blame our major, because normally if the weather had stayed all right, because by the time we got to Dover, it was more or less raining again. See, it was very, very poor. It was good. I was looking for that sheet. He said the big sheet.
Now, you said you left the squadron the next day. Well, that was... You were leaving anyway, were you? So you left the squadron?
I left, yes, right. Yeah.
How was that just your normal demobilisation? That was when you were demobilised?
I could tell you a bit about that. Very much so. He sent me down to... I think it was Saint-Omer. I went down to France the day I was demobbed. I had to stay there one night at this place. I'll never forget, the bed I was in was short of clothes. I was froze stiff almost that night, see. And I had to bring a party of infantry chaps over to Fovent on Salisbury Plain to be demobbed. Same as I was, see. As I say, I was a fool to come out, but when I got there, I had to be demobbed the same as others. But one thing I did rather get upset over, he went through all my stuff I had to hand back that was issued, like the Sidcut suit, no, that sort of thing. I had to hand that back, look, see. And one thing I had to hand back was my helmet. And that was a moleskin helmet. Their helmet was a leather thing. Nobody liked the darn things, ungainly things. And I must have given it away. I don't know what I did with it, but... I used this other one, and I had to hand that back in place of the other. I must pay more than I wanted to pay anyway for the other one, see. So that was my demob.
Now, you said you were a fool. Did you have the chance of staying in the RAF?
They sent a party out. As I told you, a number 1-2 squadron was looked upon as one of the elite squadrons. They sent a party out from the Air Ministry to interview us all. First of all, that whole party on parade, I think it was about 3 of them, Air Ministry chaps, and they read a letter out thanking the squadron for their services during the war, us including everybody. And after that, they interviewed every officer with a view to him applying for a permanent commission. It was rather sudden. Now I must tell you this, Peter. You might say, well, I was a fool to come out. Perhaps I was, but I am still alive. Now, I was brought up at Almondsbury. We had a lovely position and all that, but it was a small cottage without the usual amenities, you know, and it wasn't a place that I'd want to invite air marshals to or anything like that. And I said to these chaps that were running the panel, I said, could I, have I to make up my mind now? He said, afraid you must. I said, can I, we say, join the Army of Occupation? Give me a chance to find out how things are going to work out? He said, well, I'm sorry, but we just can't do that. It's either yes or no. So I came out, and I regretted almost straight away, see. And what I did think was, now Pendred, you see him here, Pendred, he became Air Marshal Sir Lord Lawrence Pendred, KGB, all the rest of it, see. And he did nothing to train him like I did. And I could have, I could tell you another story about that. I was talking to a man that CEO Nethery at what's the name down by Old, down by Salisbury, Old Sarum. I was went down to Old Sarum, had a visit there, and saw the CEO, and he said you were in the service. When I told him where I was, he said, "Why didn't you stay on?" I said, "Well, I told him, you know, more or less the truth." He said, "Well, it's a pity," he said, "because all your colleagues went up the ladder, you know." And I mentioned some names, and I sent him some photographs of these chaps that he knew. And he said, you'd have got up the ladder. Well, I might have done, but perhaps I'm not cut out for that sort of job.
So what did you do then? You came out. What did you do?
Then I went back to this firm. Now, the firm I was working to, see, started doing...
Was that
they had
Smith?
To reorganise, same as everybody else. We did steel constructional work.
Was that Smith's?
Yeah, that was steel... That's nothing to do with the original job, really. This is steel constructional work that they were started up. They built a factory and used to make the steel work for... Not very big buildings, but any small buildings, you get steelwork, and they used to put the erected out to chaps, you know, subcontract for all the erecting and stuff. For a while, I used to go around and help out, supervise these jobs and help out. So my wife got a little bit fed up with that, been on her own so much, and I left and went down to the works. Of course, you've got no record of me at the works, have you?
No. What did you do there?
Well, I don't know whether I told Brad King about it or not.
Not on tape, you didn't.
But I think I did more for my country in the Second War than I did the First War.
So what did you
now,
do?
Now, I'll start now. This is January 1937. I visited a friend of mine, a chap named Clinch, just died actually, and he knew of course where I worked and all that sort of thing. He said, Podge, he was called me Podge, he said, how about coming to work with us? Oh, I said, I hadn't given that a thought. Name was Alfred, really. We used to call him Albert, so I hadn't given that a thought. I said, how much you paying? I wanted to get back to the works because we could see war was coming. And I wanted to get in on the works. So I said, what's your wages? And he told me, well, it's with overtime, it was more than I was getting, although I wasn't getting bad money. But with a couple of nights overtime, Tuesdays and Thursdays, it worked out better. But it was the fact that I wanted to get back amongst aeroplanes.
Now, what was the firm you were joining? What was the name of the firm and the factory?
I left.
That you were joining.
Oh, this is the Bristol Aeroplane Company. Oh, didn't I mention that? Oh, yes, Bristol Aeroplane Company.
And where was the factory?
Down here at Patchway.
Patchway...
That's right, it's down at Patchway.
So someone from Bristol would know where that was?
That's only a couple of miles down there. Anyway, I'll go on with that in a minute. So I said, all right, off. I said, I'll try it. Now, nobody, I said, on one condition, I said, my past doesn't come into it. I said, if I get anything, I said, I'll have to work for it. I said, I don't want any favours. I don't believe in favours. So, all right. So, I went to the works. He introduced me. I went in there. Now he said, for the first... for the first month, you better go on the test. I'm on the test bench. And see what will be expected of you if you go on to the test facilities or maintenance. All right. So I went on to the test. I'll never forget that first week. And I was on what they call number four bed.
What were these test beds? Can you just explain?
They're dynamometers, what they call dynamometers. They're water filled, you see. And they're quite big things, these test beds, you know. See? So I went on to the test beds, but our job was to... When I got there, there was, I think, about three coppersmiths, a tinsmith, and a fitter cut welder, but they were borrowed from other departments. The test didn't have a real test shop, workshop. They were borrowed. They were building the whole of these tests for the war. They were getting prepared, you see. And they built on the other side of the road these tests. And I went there, and I'll never forget it. On the Friday, Gilbert Waugh, the chap that was running it, said, Ernie said, I want to get off tonight. Could you tune that engine for me? I said, yes, all right, Gilbert. He said, when do you want the inspector? He said, send the apprentice. I had an apprentice for me. Send the apprentice. So when I was tuning this engine, I was ready. I said to the apprentice, I said, did you get the inspector? He said, where's that? Oh, I said, well, just engine was ticking over. I said, leave things out there. I said, I'll go and get the inspector. I went to the inspector and I said, a chap named Groundwater, I said, will you come on number four, please? He said, who's over there? I said, only the apprentice now. I said, he said, who's running it? I said, well, I'm running it. You? He said, you've only been here a few days, have you? I said, yes, he said. And you expect me to come and inspect an engine you've chewed? I said, it's up to you. Oh, shut the bloody thing down, he said. I'm not coming and attend to an engine you've chewed, you know, like. So I shut it down. Of course, it was a bit of a rumpus. What you had to do to tune it...
What type of an engine was it?
That was a Pegasus.
That was used in which plane?
What they call Peggy 18. It had a two-speed blower, see.
And what was it used for, usually? What plane would it go in?
What plane? Oh, it went in various planes, mine. It was a very common engine.
Right.
A very good engine.
So what happened next day, then?
Well, anyway, they had to hush it up a little bit, see. What I would have had to have done was to set the slow running, set the power jet, which comes in at certain revs, and set what they call the overriding rod on the boost. I was a bit annoyed about it, see. I thought, there's a fool here. I've been through the School of Aeronautics. They asked me to tune that engine, he's not going to inspect it. I didn't tell him anything about myself, look. Well, I stayed on that test for about a month, and owing to that and the prejudice I was receiving, I decided to go on with the maintenance side. And I can tell you a long story about that. As I said, they just starting to increase production, and this chap, there was one chap there assumed to be the sort of charge hand, and they came from other departments, and I had to I was sort of fitter, general mechanic, like, you know. When it come that I stayed on there, and I was getting loaded up with all sorts of jobs and all, you know. And I said to a fella, had some new blokes come, I said, I would like a spot of nights. Oh, he said, that'd do me fine. He said, my mate will bring me in. And he turned up on the Monday, and I said, you let me down. I said, I thought you were coming on nights. He said, he wouldn't stand for that. I said, who's that? This bloke, he was called Harold Lloyd. He said, you're playing darts, you see, out at the pub. He said, I'm on nights next week. He said, who said? So I did. This chap said, who's running the blinking job? Here, me. I wasn't expected to, wasn't trying to run anything. So he let me down. I went to the big shot. I said, "You give me my cards, please." I was getting fed up with the place. I said, "You give me my cards, please." He said, "What's gone wrong?" I wouldn't tell him, and he locked me in. He said, "I've got to know." And when I told him, of course, he went down to Phelan, where this other chap was still, perhaps went in the Phelan Inn for a pub and all that. They were having a good time. He was down there, and I was doing all the donkey work. He gave me a rise and said, "Look," he said, "you're running this job, but," he said, "it's unofficial." Because, he said, the unions know that we're building up a workshop, and they know somebody left to run it, and they wanted to put their own foreman in it, and they said, "We're not having it." He said, "You're going to do it." So he said, "We're not going to put anything on the paper, on the board or anything like that. You just carry on as you are, but you are in charge, see." And they got out of it like that to a certain extent. So the unions started to worry me. And I was doing a brazing job, quite a big flange I had to on a cover. And I finished, and I went like this, you know, it was hot. And a chap was stood by me, he said, "Yes, that's all right." I said, "Why shouldn't it be all right?" Well, he said, "You're not a coppersmith, are you?" I said, "What the hell's that got to do with it?" He said, "Well, that's a coppersmith's job." I said, "You get yourself away, mate." I said, "You haven't been in the trade very long, have you?" I said, "Brazing is an engineer's job." I said, "Anybody can do that in the engineer line." I said, "Another thing." I said, "I've used silver solder on this." I said, "Not where I was working." I said, "That'd have to be a hard smelter. That's very expensive, silver solder." And I said, "This that with them one is no object, see." And there was one or two other things arise. Now, what the climax was this, and I can tell you, Peter, it wasn't an easy job. I was brought up in a workshop. I knew all about the tools and all that. I had to give them a list of all the tools I wanted and the material and that sort of thing. And I went down to this East Test, what they call the East Test. That's 9 dynamometers, 2 cable hangers, and 9 test beds. Quite a lot to look after, see. So the manager came to me. He said, "I have a letter here from the Air Ministry." He said, "They want all the engines they can get for these bombers. They don't care how they get them. They must have the engines." He said, "You've got a free hand." They couldn't have draftsmen sit down drawing things. I mean, it wasn't a room time for that sort of thing. So he said, "And if I'd have gone to the drawing, cooperated with them, I should have been held up, whereas I could go straight to the men, have the jobs done." So he said, "You have a free hand. If you want any assistance from any department and you can't get it, let me know. Get me on the phone," he said, "but you'll get it." And I did. I had to get certain things done, tool room, turn and that sort of thing. And Peter, to keep that job running, it was 24 hours, almost. I was almost on beck and call 24 hours. I was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. You had to. We were turning out 200 engines a week.
That's throughout the war.
That's during the war, see, for these bombers.
Could you keep the quality up?
Pardon?
Could you keep the quality up, turning that many out?
Well, they had a quality to work to. They did pretty well. But just reminds me, mind, but I didn't tell you, if I got that far, when I went round and collected all the test stuff from the aerodromes. Have I told you anything about that?
No.
Oh, well, I'll break in with that. This is 1941. I think it was 41. They called me down at the office. Whether they knew I'd ever been in the Air Force or not, I don't know. And they said, "Would I undertake a very dangerous job?" Well, I said, first of all, they said, "Would I undertake an outside job?" Well, I said, "Have I any option?" They said, "You have, because this is a very dangerous job." we cannot ask you to do it. You can volunteer for it, but it must be done. And if you volunteer, so much the better. Well, I said, I'm not a stranger to danger. That's it. And they gave me a son of a build, local builder, a chap named Dick Whittingham. Poor chap died fairly young. But he was a lovely fella. And we went to, first to East Church. And what happened to the East? It took me too long to tell now. I went to East Church. Then I went to Kenley. That's a hot spot right on in London, you know, by Purley. Then I went to Northolt. I went up on the east coast to Northcotes, down to Felixstowe, into Henlow, went down on the south coast to Carshot, and
but what were you doing?
No, well, I got to tell you. Each aerodrome has its own test equipment, test stand and all. They do their own top overhauls, repairs. Well, after that, those engines not only got to be running, they got to be tuned. They must be tuned, what with the boost and all that sort of thing. So they got their own little, their own test bed. All these was doing Bristol engines, and generally they were out in the open, these places, see. So I had to, with this lad, dismantle all this stuff. We used to ring up the aerodrome, and they'd send up a truck and take it away, and it went down to Fayland down here, and they put a quarry in, test stand in a quarry using all this equipment. None of that has ever been recorded anywhere. And what I could tell you, it's quite a story, the whole lot of it. What I can tell you, when I get to we were at Northolt, and we were stopping at Ruislip, which is quite close, see. We went first thing in the morning, and the chap at the gate said, the sergeant at the gate said, you may as well go home. Oh, I said, like that, is it? He said, yes. And we went down there, and the bomb had landed by the side of this stand, and lifted it clean off the, we'd taken the nuts off, lifted it clean off the stand and put it down by the side almost. Very little damage. That's what they wanted, the stands, as much as anything, see. And there was other places where bombs, they were bombing while we were asleep, you know. They were having a good go at this. I know down at Felixstowe, they dropped one in the garden at the bottom of our place. Yeah, we were so used to it. I'll never forget the...
Now, how are these airfields meant to manage without their test beds, then?
It only meant a difference of transport. The engines had to be transported. They had to lose that lot. But it's all done quickly. Had to send them down to Fayland.
So all of
or
that...
Or get them tested elsewhere.
All of that was done centrally now.
What they want was the material, the stands and all. See, they couldn't replace those stands, the test stands and that. That's the reason for salvaging it. It would have caused that. Unless it's got to all be done at once, you know, very quick. As I say, the certain things that happened there, they seem to be following us around with all this bombing. Down at, I never forget Carshot. We were at Carshot. And we wanted to go into Purley. Oh, I beg your pardon, Whiteleaf. We were at Whiteleaf then. Carshot was the other place. Whiteleaf, that's down by the aerodrome. And we thought we'd go into Purley. And this was in the evening. And the sirens went. As we were well away from the aerodrome, we stood and watched. It was good to watch. Not to be with, but there was the shells bursting. Of course, the sirens had gone, look, see. And there was the guns blazing away and the searchlight playing about. It was good to watch. I saw that on two or three occasions. So we survived it, and I stayed to run that test. Of course, I was made a foreman as soon as when the war finished, they wouldn't ask me to be a foreman. They knew better than that. Peter, this house, which I bought at the time, well, I was a charge hand. I was getting the normal rate of pay. I was getting the test shop bonus. I was getting ability rate. I was getting time and a half and double time for Sundays, time and a half for Saturdays, you know, all the overtime. And my wages was more than what I would have got as a foreman some way. And that's how it stayed until the end of the war, and then I was put on the staff. So I lost money by going on the staff, but I did get on the pension scheme, which has helped since, but I had to pay extra to make up the time I'd lost. But that was something that there was other things that went on in the test that you never hear about. On one occasion I saved the test